Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Fanalytics Podcast. Mike Lewis and Doug Battle brought to you by Emory's Marketing Analytics Center. Doug, your lighting looks better than mine today.
I think it's just my face, Mike.
Okay, maybe it's the allergies. I look a little tired.
I'm just kidding. No, okay. I got that pep in my step because it's the final 4 week and I'm glowing, Mike.
Okay,
glowing
over here. A B12 shot or something. Okay, so it is final 4 week, Doug. Very different from last year's final four. Last year's final four was Kansas, North Carolina, Villanova, and Duke. This year's final four are some other guys.
I know. Yeah, some other guys. Right when I think that I changed my strategy up because I have this habit of always picking the craziest scenarios, wanting to be the one person that picked it. And there's been so many years, like last year, where it's Villanova and Kansas and Duke and UNC, where you're like, you know what? Maybe it is the 1 and 2 seeds, and that's how I'm going to win the bracket. So this year, I went heavy on that. And I'm not alone, though, Mike. Only 37 of 20 million ESPN brackets have a perfect Final Four. And I'm not saying that's a perfect bracket. I'm saying a perfect Final Four. So that's 0.00185% who picked FAU, UConn, San Diego State, and Miami in their Final Four. I'm assuming each of those people made about 72 brackets.
I can't even imagine that there are any with that Final Four.
Yeah. Yeah. So we got three teams that are in their first Final Four ever. And then UConn, which is like, UConn's kind of a staple, but it, I mean, it's been since 2014, since they made a big run in the tournament. And so I don't think anyone expected UConn to make the run that they have. FAU is going to play in front of more people in the Final Four than they've played in front of the entire season. If you add up all the games in their home stadium, San Diego State, another one. I know them because of Kawhi Leonard, but you know, not necessarily a team that anyone was really high on going into this. And Miami is a team that trailed Drake 56-53 in the first round with 2 minutes left. Was not the face of the ACC, you know, not a team that ran their conference this year, and they made it to the Elite Eight last year. That's a team that seems to turn it on come tournament time. So one of my takeaways, and you know, I'm not going to take credit for this. Adrian Theory, Emory's student, who sent me over some numbers between these four teams. Mike, there are 10 fifth-year seniors and there are 4 fourth-year juniors. So there's a bit of a COVID effect in this year's tournament where, and I think we saw this in college football with 25-year-old Stetson Bennett kind of running the show, where there's some level of parity that comes from these small, well, of course, this isn't this isn't college football. What I'm talking about here is with college basketball, some of these smaller teams have those upperclassmen where you have the 23, 24-year-olds competing against 18-year-olds at Kentucky. And maybe that gives, that levels the playing field a bit. And, you know, teams like FAU, teams like San Diego State have a better shot this year. Maybe we should have seen this coming.
Look, I'm going to admit that I got something wrong, right? Yeah. When NIL was going down, I thought we were going to see this concentration of power. Now, you know, when NIL and the transfer portal was relaxed, I thought we were going to see extreme movement towards the blue bloods and both to the elite schools. I think we have seen that in football. I mean, it's relatively new, but it seems like we're seeing that solidify in college football, but not at all in college basketball. And college basketball has something strange going on, right? And I mean, you as a Georgia fan have seen, you know, during Tom Crean's disastrous time in Athens, you know, they were probably had the most folks transferring in and out every year, but this is everywhere now. I think everyone is like ready to lose 3 to 4 guys and bring in 3 to 4 guys every year. And so is this, and again, 1 year kind of a blip of a data point, but are we moving towards this where college basketball has this set of rules makes college basketball all about parity? While it makes college football all about sort of dominant programs that are the brands that are locked in and will always be competing for the college football title. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, college football, I think we know. We're not seeing this in college football. We're not seeing, oh, you know, Samford is getting some upperclassmen, and therefore they're able to compete with Georgia. Like, that doesn't happen in that sport. But with basketball, you know, a lot of these freshman phenoms, which is really what it's all about when you're talking about the talent, like the kind of lopsided recruiting, these guys are tending to disappear in the tournament. This year, Brandon Miller at Alabama, one of the maybe the top college basketball player this year, 28 points across three games in the tournament. He went 8-for-41 shooting and 3-for-19 from three. And you look across the board, like Nick Smith Jr. at Arkansas, he went 2-for-10 against Kansas. That's another top prospect. Keontae George at Baylor shot 3-for-19 in the tournament. And so, you know, I think that teams that are relying too heavily on these younger players who maybe don't have the composure of some of the upperclassmen that we see at like FAU, San Diego State, UConn, and Miami, I think that that's what's giving parity. And I got those numbers from Adrian Theory again, trying to discern whether the tournament is a good indicator of NBA success. Looking over the years, seeing, is this, you know, with the NFL, we look at, we talk about the Parcells rules, and do quarterbacks, are they winning games in college? Are they playing enough years? Are they playing with basketball? I don't know that there's a set standard of rules for determining that. And so something I've been curious about is, like, do the scouts, do they put too much emphasis in the tournament? Do they look at a guy and say, wow, he really came alive in the tournament, he's got the clutch gene, and run with it and draft him too high? Or do they let off on a guy because he had a poor outing in the tournament and didn't show up in a big game? And that player, you know, it was just the player was always going to regress to the mean. And so that's something I'm looking at this year with a guy like Brandon Miller. Does he fall in the draft after disappearing in the tournament? Keontae George, Nick Smith Jr. And Adrian raised a good point to the contrary. There's been plenty of examples of these top prospects who perform very well in the tournament. Kevin Durant, we talked last week about Anthony Davis, you know, DeMarcus Cousins, Chris Paul, Carmelo Anthony, Kevin Love. You can go down the line. There's been plenty of success stories. Stephen Curry, a guy who really put his name on the map and brought his school to the map.
I think you have to look at the sort of different eras in all this, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
You know, there's an iconic picture of Michael Jordan still, and, you know, it says the Jordan brand continues with a movie. What is that called? A cinnamon cream.
Sorry. I said a movie about his shoes.
Yeah, movie about his shoes, right? And, you know, but I always
this isn't that. The first movie about his shoes, like, yeah. Mike.
Yeah, but I just think of, you know, the picture of like him cutting down the net, right? And it's like, you know, so we've gone through that era where tournament success was everything to, you know, the era where, you know, people went straight from high school to the pros, to the one and dones. And, you know, as you're talking, I pulled up one of the mock drafts. I think this is from NBC Sports, and, you know, their number one projected player is Wemby, you know, the French player. Yeah. Then they have Scoot Henderson playing, yep, G League Ignite.
Yep.
Then you've got Amen Thompson from Overtime Elite. It's only when you get to Brandon Miller at Alabama at number, yeah, four, and then number six is a player from Houston. So, you know, I suspect that we've also seen a rapid hollowing out of the, you know, the NBA with some of the G League stuff has rapidly hollowed out college basketball on top of the, and again, you know, the level of transferring in college basketball at this point is just strange.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that needs to reach some sort of equilibrium because it's not doing anyone any favors. It's not doing the players favors. It's not doing the program's favors. It's not doing the sport, the industry, any favors. Doug, I looked it up here as well that, excuse me, allergy season, that last year's Duke North Carolina game, which, you know, special circumstances, right, of Coach K's final game, drew 17.6 million people. And then the championship game was about 16 or 17 million people. What do you think this Final Four comes to? Gosh.
I don't, it's like, there's two sides to it, because on the one hand, you don't have those UNC Duke fan bases, those staples, which, by the way, I think those schools spend a lot of resources trying to recruit the Scoot Hendersons of the world. And I think it's killing them to be competing against the G League, to be competing against foreign leagues and pour your resources and your time and energy where you could be recruiting a top college level player, but you're going after a professional level player and they end up deciding to go to the pros. And now you're stuck having to take the second pick of the college players. And so I think that's part of what's going on. But with those schools out of the mix, someone like me that doesn't have a dog in the fight, I'm actually more interested. I'm more interested in the Final Four this year because one of FAU, UConn, San Diego State, and Miami is going to win a national championship.
Okay. Let me put something out there and you can react to it. So here's where I think the structure of college basketball fandom looks like. You got your diehards. And I think you used to be kind of in the diehard territory where it's like, you know, I got a team. My team is Duke. My team is UCLA. I also, you know, hate Kentucky. This kind of individual that pays attention all year or largely pays attention all year. Then you've got this group of people that is all about the brackets, right? Sports gambling, there's nothing better for increasing engagement. Suddenly I've got a little bit, and it's not even the dollars, right? There's a competition along the lines. I'm at the office, family bragging rights. And, you know, and the first day of the tournament, it's great, right? It's like, it's built for engagement. I got Cinderella's. And then maybe I got, well, and maybe those are the two sort of core fan bases that are going to come out for this. And so if everyone's bracket is broken, you know, are they still coming out for this?
Yeah.
And if, you know, the big dogs, sort of the glamour brands are gone, and look, Duke brings Duke fans. It also brings folks that want to see Duke lose.
They hate Duke. Yeah. It's like, right, LeBron.
I want to see FAU beat Duke, right? To win this championship. So, and again, it's just a projection. Where do we come in relative to last year with sort of this iconic college basketball figure? 10, 12? It'll be interesting to see.
It'll be interesting to see. Something that I've always lost interest as the tournament goes on because I don't have a dog in the fight. And so your bracket in those first two rounds is at its best. You have a dog in the fight in that sense. And then the Cinderellas tend to burn out come the Sweet 16 after those first two rounds. So I've always been a proponent of the first two rounds being the best part of the basketball season. And I lose interest. I kind of tune out come the Elite Eight, unless like Virginia or some team that I have some sort of tie to is in it. Or like you said, Duke, if I want to see them lose to UMBC or St. Mary's or whatever team is in there. And so, you know, but Adrian brought up another statistic for me that kind of makes me interested in the Final Four this year. And it's that the average round point differentials, I was telling him, I was saying, it seems like the games are more of blowouts as the tournament goes on, which is kind of counterintuitive because when a 16 is playing a 1, you expect that to be a blowout. And then when a 1 is playing a 2, you expect that to be a close game. But it seems like the Final Four, we've seen more blowouts. And this year, it's felt like the Elite Eight. But it's actually not the case this year. Average point differential in each round. First round was 11.78. Second round, 10 or 11.25. Third round, 10.25. And Elite Eight, 9.75. And so, in that sense, it's like there's more likely to be a buzzer beater or overtime or the type of game that causes a lot of buzz on social and then causes people to tune in. That's another element where just the closeness of the games can draw interest. So there's kind of a push and pull here, and we'll find out next week. I definitely want to look at the numbers after the Final Four and see kind of where we came in. But like you said, you know, it's not going to be as high as it was for Duke UNC. That's just not going to happen.
It just can't happen, right?
Yeah.
And that was sort of magic. I mean, coming out of COVID, that was really about the best case scenario for college basketball to have Duke versus UNC.
Right.
This year, again, I'm like, in some ways, I'm just like struggling to get my mind around it. I'm absolutely going to be fascinated by the way this number comes in on the TV ratings. I mean, and in a way, it's kind of sad that I'm more interested in the number on the TV ratings than I am in sort of who's going to walk away with this championship. Doug, I can't even imagine a scenario where a school called Florida Atlantic University wins the NCAA tournament.
You know, the funny thing about Florida Atlantic is they're technically the Cinderella at this point, even though that was a 30-win team in the regular 30-plus, I think like 32 wins or something in the regular season, but they're technically the Cinderella. People don't like FAU because they don't act like they've been there before, and they rub a lot of people the wrong way in how they win. I think a lot of people will just say, hey, they're lucky, and they think that they're good, and they're kind of that team. And so I know quite a few people who want to see them humbled. Maybe they're just bitter because FAU is a team that busted their bracket or knocked their team out of the tournament. But kind of an interesting Cinderella in the sense that it's not like George Mason where the whole country is uniting around FAU right now. I don't know that the country's uniting around any one team or player. It's more of just kind of a general interest. And maybe that's going to be detrimental to the ratings that you're talking about. But FAU being in the Final Four, that's a school where if I think a lot of people probably before the tournament didn't know they had Division I sports.
Not at all, right? I mean, and again, you'd like go through the list of the NCAA champions that have occurred and think about what's going on with college football. Could have a San Diego State winning a national championship, could have a Florida, you know, an FAU. You know, one of the things, look, I'm nothing but rooting for those schools.
Oh,
because
yeah.
I love...
You know, I do not want to see UConn or Miami win this. No. No way.
But, you know, it's like that's, and I want to see what happens next, right? Because, I mean, in terms of all the Cinderellas we've had over the years, they never get it all the way done, do they? I mean, I don't know who the sort of the closest thing
Cinderella
is to have actually won it.
Butler.
Okay.
Butler, Duke, Gordon Hayward. Full court shot at the end of the game, rimmed out, would have won the game against Duke, would have been the greatest moment in sports history, and they were that close. Brad Stevens is the coach, so that's the closest I've seen. But yeah, George Mason fizzled out, UNBC fizzled out. I mean, every year there's a team, and they, you know, they tend to fizzle out at the very latest in the Final Four round. And so FAU, again, this isn't like a team that didn't win games during the season and snuck into the tournament. They dominated Conference USA, which to that point, Mike, I just want to say Conference USA should get more than one spot in the tournament because every single year, the one team from Conference USA that makes it goes on a run. They at least make the round of 32 and pull an upset in the first round. This year it was Florida Atlantic. I'm a UAB guy. I grew up in Birmingham. I used to go to all the UAB games. I always thought they were the best basketball program in the state of Alabama, which at the time they definitely were. Now, probably not the case with Alabama and Auburn ramping up their basketball programs. But UAB had a year this year and a team that a lot of people in Birmingham thought was capable of going on a March run. And unfortunately, due to, you know, definitely a top 64 team in the country, but due to the structure of the tournament, conferences like Conference USA, even if they have a top four team in the country in their conference, they only get one bid. And that second team, even if they're like the number 35 team, they're not going to get a shot. And that's part of March Madness that's a little frustrating for those mid-majors where the regular season doesn't really matter. All that matters is the conference tournament because the winner of that is going to go to March Madness. And I know UAB had a season a couple years back where they actually didn't have a great season, went on a run in the tournament, won the Conference USA tournament, and won the first round of March. And, you know, FAU was probably the other team that got left out that probably had 28 wins in the season that year, or however many. And so, you know, it's conferences like that, I think we learn in the tournament. Maybe we're putting too much weight into the Big Ten and giving them too many teams. And maybe conferences like Conference USA aren't getting enough love.
I don't have a lot of response to that. It does speak to the economics of the sport and to, you know, the level of competitive balance, the economics of the sport, not just the economics of the sport, but the nature of and importance of brands to college sports. And it seems like, you know, even if you're saying that, and look, I get the perspective. It seems unimaginable that the Big Ten gets left out of anything, right? Or the
I'm
SEC
not saying left out.
But it's, you know, I think, you know, just when I, as I think about how this stuff, look, I mean, there was a real beauty, you know, in some ways when college basketball and college football's brand equity were built, and probably more so college basketball, it was, you know, this stuff is built over generations. And so you think about, you know, I think about like where, when I was, you know, grow up in Chicago, the DePauls and the Marquettes and the Loyolas, and, you know, these places had nice little basketball programs. And, you know, sometimes it, like DePaul had a great basketball program for a while. Mm-hmm. And they go from independence to being in conferences, and with all the conference realignment, you know, it's like college basketball, I guess in some ways kind of feels like it's all shook up to me. Like as you start talking about Conference USA, I actually had to look it up to see who was in it.
Yeah.
So it's, and it is a, you look, and all I could think about is like, well, if I'm putting together this conference, I can imagine the steps they're going through of trying to get some regional, you know, to try and hit certain markets, to kind of to have a decent footprint, and also have enough kind of like schools and cities. Like, well, we got Birmingham with UAB. Mm-hmm. But it's a tough uphill battle at this point when you think about the utter dominance of the Big Ten, you know, going out and getting... Look, looking forward, the Big Ten's adding USC in football and UCLA in basketball, right? And of course, they're adding them in both sports. But you get what I'm saying is the consolidation. Look, at least in college basketball, they let Florida Atlanta have a shot, right?
Yeah, they give them a shot, and you don't see that in college football. Maybe in the future, yeah. Of course, I don't think it would fare the same way in college football, and I think we all know that. But with basketball, I guess my point is, at what point do, when we're doing strength of schedule, it's usually essentially, if you trail it back, it roots in preseason rankings, which aren't really based on anything. And it's kind of more based on perception of conference. And the Big Ten has kind of, over the last couple of years, had this perception of elite when maybe it hasn't performed that well in the tournament. And in, you know, some conferences that have this perception as tiny and minuscule and insignificant actually translate really well when they're playing against, you know, elite teams from other conferences. And so I'm just curious if at any point somebody takes a step back and is like, maybe we're ranking them wrong from the get-go, and that's kind of skewing our views of these teams. And teams like Florida Atlantic, who, like I have said many times, won over 30 games in the regular season, maybe it wasn't just because their competition was terrible. Maybe they actually were playing teams that were more on par with, you know, and I'm not saying their competition is as good as a Big Ten schedule, but I'm just saying maybe it's closer than we think. And maybe some of those other teams should get a look as well. Because clearly you could be the number five team in the country right now and not be in the tournament if you're in Conference USA.
Well, Doug, and at this point I have to think, we're having a reasoned conversation, you know, we're being analytical, thinking about the incentives and the structures. But, you know, then I have to catch myself and go, yeah, but last year it was Villanova and Kansas, and the conclusion was that, you know, all this shift NIL and transfer portal had solidified the control of the power players. This year, with a very different group, San Diego, Florida Atlantic, you know, UConn, that, you know, so let's just watch it play out, I guess.
Yeah. And I also want to piggyback on that and say, I kind of am of the opinion that this year's an outlier, which I mean, we all know that, but specifically in regards to those COVID seniors, the fifth year seniors, that is such an advantage. And I saw it like watching Georgia football this year and kind of wondering in retrospect, would Georgia have won the last two national championships had it not had a 24, 25-year-old quarterback, had it not had veterans? You know, our Georgia's safety was a guy who sat behind Richard LeCount for 3 years and then started for 2 years. And it's like you basically have an NFL veteran leading your defense. You basically have an NFL veteran quarterback. And that gives you such an advantage compared to the years where you have a true freshman or sophomore or junior at those positions, which is usually the case for a school like Georgia. And with college basketball, you know, I don't know that we're ever going to see 10 fifth-year seniors in the Final Four ever again. And so when that changes, does the balance go back to the kind of top heavy younger teams that maybe have a couple upperclassmen but are led by young guys? And I don't know. We'll see. I just think that those teams, even pre-COVID, kind of struggled. Like Zion Williamson and RJ Barrett did not make the Final Four. And that year, a Virginia team with Kyle Guy and Jerome and, you know, a bunch of older basketball players won the national championship. They did have one, you know, DeAndre Hunter, one lottery pick player on that team. And maybe that's the formula, having a number of veteran guys who've played together, as well as a little bit, you know, sprinkle of that elite talent, younger talent, to chip in and give you an athletic advantage. That's personally, if I'm Duke, if I'm UNC, that's kind of how I'm recruiting, trying to go for a lot of guys that are going to be there, and, you know, one or two a year that are going to be lottery picks. But we'll see the approach that those schools take, and we'll see what translates in the Final Four years post COVID.
And I'll speculate that it probably is something where you got to move down the rankings and try and keep guys, as you know, when you add in the transfers, and try and keep guys for 5 years.
Four and five years.
Yeah. You know, it's always been that notion, right? That the teams with the senior guards are going to play well into March. And I suspect that becomes ever more true, right? Guys that have 4 years in your program or 5 years. I mean, again, the idea of redshirting seems crazy now, right? But 5 years in the program and hitting, you know, threes under pressure, probably the long-term business plan for these places. Okay, Doug, so moving ahead, you mentioned an older quarterback who I think is older than, today we're talking about sort of reviewing the NFC East. And I want to say, was Stetson Bennett older than Jalen Hurts? Is older, I guess? Not was.
I don't know about that one, because my senior year at Georgia, Jalen Hurts, I think Stetson was a freshman and Jalen Hurts was a sophomore. So I think he's right. He might be older, though. Maybe Stetson was held back. Maybe he was redshirted. Kids in my school used to do that.
Hey, Jalen Hurts is 24 years old, Doug.
Okay, so yeah, so Stetson's a year older. But I mean, right there, you know, one of the older quarterbacks in the NFC East, if he ends up in that division. Of course, Dak Prescott's a little bit older than him. I'm not sure where Daniel Jones is, but we'll talk about Daniel Jones.
Well, okay, so the NFC East last year, Jalen Hurts, and again, I'll sort of give my quick preseason view on these guys. Jalen Hurts strikes me as a very average quarterback going into the year, has a breakthrough season. I haven't run the numbers yet. I don't know that I'm fully convinced that I'll be careful here because everyone gets very upset. I don't know where Hurts ranks in terms of NFL quarterbacks. I don't know if he's a top 10 guy. I don't think he's a top 5 guy. But he may end up being kind of a top 10 to 15 guy. So he's a very interesting player that had a fantastic year. Number two on the list, Dak Prescott. Dak has had some great statistical years. Last year was not one of them, being the position he plays. Doug, I don't know. You know, Dallas Cowboy quarterback might be the biggest job in all of professional sports. American professional sports. There's probably, you know, probably playing striker for Man U means even more.
Right.
But Prescott, you know, will always be under the microscope, always sort of be, you know, questions about him as long as he plays in Dallas. We had a player you paid a lot of attention to, Daniel Jones, have in some ways, from a business perspective, a strange year where it seemed like they didn't want him, but then signed him to a nice deal afterwards. And then the Washington Commanders with a complete washout of a season in terms of quarterbacks and likely to draft a guy in the first round coming up in this year's NFL draft.
Or make a trade?
No. Okay, you mentioned there's a rumor going around just as we were turning the mics on. So what's the rumor?
Lamar Jackson tweeted himself. He requested a trade from the Baltimore Ravens. And you know what's right down the road from Baltimore? That's Washington, D.C. I know some Commanders fans who'd be pretty excited about that.
Yeah, that's a tough one, right? Because the Washington football franchise has, you know, an economic situation that can potentially, you know, afford to put up the money. You know, part of the issue with guaranteed money is the owner has to be wealthy enough to put the money into escrow, right?
Yeah.
And so the Washington Commanders, and I don't know Daniel Snyder's relative position amongst the billionaires, but just the nature of that brand and the market they're in would seem to have the financial resources to do it. And I also think, and again, you know, you can push back on me if you want. The Commanders might be one of these franchises that is desperate enough to overpay for a Lamar Jackson. And also, so we could see that going to, I could see that happening. That'd be a good fit.
I could too. And Dan Snyder has a history of trading the farm for an athletic quarterback. RG3 is who
he has a history of some of the worst free agent signings.
Well, and that's another thing that makes me think, because you've been so, you know, looking at, I hope people understand, because I've seen some hate for discussion regarding Lamar Jackson. It's not that Lamar Jackson's not a good football player. It's looking at it from a economical standpoint, and with scarce resources, is this the best way to use them? And historically, I think on this show, the opinion is that that's not the case. And so with that said, the Washington Commanders have football team slash, yeah, I'm trying to think of all their names. They have the Commies. They have a history of making those moves where you look at the numbers and you look at, do you remember, was it Ndamukong Suh, or there was some Albert Haynesworth. Bringing that to it was that they paid him crazy money to come in past his prime.
And he essentially retired from active service after he got that money. He said in class as an example, something called the winner's curse.
Yeah.
Where the team that overvalues the player is the one that gets them.
Yeah.
And I think if you talk to Washington football fans, that is their frustration with that ownership, is that they've always gotten those things wrong and just crippled the franchise.
The thing about fans though is that I know the Washington Commies fans that I'm friends with will sell themselves on the idea if it happens, just like they did with RG3, just like they did with Albert Haynesworth. And
Doug, they're instantly relevant. They'd be absolutely, I mean, that, and that's the key, right? Suddenly there's excitement around this franchise.
Otherwise, exactly. And but
Doug, it's Lamar Jackson or Will Levis.
That's a conversation for another day.
But I'm not saying who's going to be the better quarterback, even. I'm just saying in terms of the media environment and the fan excitement.
Well, it's exciting. And as a fan, you sell yourself on that. But when it doesn't work, when it doesn't lead to Super Bowls, you flip the script and you say, I knew that was idiotic. I knew that wasn't a good move. And we need to fire the guy who did it. Even though I was super stoked when it happened. I was that guy, Mike, I've talked about this before on the show, the Brooklyn Nets. They brought in Joe Johnson, Darren Williams, Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce, traded the farm. Terrible move long-term. You could look at it and say, these guys are past their prime. They're, you know, this is a second round exit in the playoffs at best. And that's exactly what happened. But at the time, it felt like the Nets are relevant. They could, they're the talk of the NBA for a hot second. And we got to just buy in here. And in retrospect, it's the worst GM in NBA history. And it's the worst trade I've ever seen. And
that's why we record these things, Doug. So my analysis of Lamar Jackson can be reduced to some unfortunate things that sound a little bit like trash talking, and I can get called out on this. But the Commanders were 8-8. I mean, think about that. You know, 8-8, that's one or two games away from the playoffs. And that's got to feel absolutely desperate in that building. I mean, again, with all the controversies and all the struggles and all the investigations, I suspect you're right. Now, if you are the general manager of the Washington Commanders and the price is you're going to have to give up, you know, at least one first round draft pick, probably a package of draft picks, including one first round pick. And Jackson wants $250 million in guaranteed money, you're also betting your career. Now, for the Washington Commanders, the owner probably wants you to, you know, may well be in a state where, I mean, the attendance at that place has been terrible. If you look at attendance rates, it's truly dropped off. It might be time to make that bet. But if it doesn't, then I think you're, as the owner, you almost got to sell the franchise and just move on to your next great mission in life.
How many of those situations has Dan Snyder survived, though? people hate that man in DC, okay, by the way. I have lots of family.
I know, but can he be having a good time with it at this point?
Yeah.
I mean,
you know, when in Ted Lasso, when the woman owner takes over for the male owner, her ex-husband, and wants to run the program into the ground. I think there could be a theory about Dan Snyder. Like, I don't know who previously owned the Washington football team or who he knows who loves the Washington football team. Maybe he has an ex-wife who adores that team and follows them religiously. And this whole thing has been one giant troll job. Just throwing that out there.
Yeah. You know, I mean, in some ways it's like the data probably fits that story. It's probably much more an example of just extreme ego. And I can run any kind of business.
I think drafting Will Levis would be the move that would make people the most mad.
Yes.
What? Because Jackson, there's at least that short-term excitement.
And again, if the storyline is that they decide to pass on trading for Lamar Jackson and then draft Will Levis. And again, the tough thing is, from a football standpoint, that might be the right thing to do. Because you also have to remember in all this that Will Levis would come in making $4 million a year versus $50 million or $60 million a year. And, you know, that cost-controlled quarterback, that ability to take the rest of that money, invest in free agents on a team that was already 8-8 and would be playing the last place schedule. You know what I mean? It in some ways, when you start to lay it out logically, the conservative approach, the non-exciting approach, might be the right thing to do. So the Washington Commanders will be signing Lamar Jackson within the,
Will Levis, to me, not to go on too much of a tangent here, but to me, he's like, ceiling is Ryan Tannehill. Like, I just think he's a bust waiting to happen. That's just my personal opinion. Some of our social followers have raised some good points recently that, because we've, there's a little debate. A little debate, Mike, that, you know, Mike made a comment a couple weeks.
So Doug is claiming that we are the only place out there that has social followers that actually raise good points and just don't complain.
I didn't claim that. No, there's just some discussion, Mike, on the Fanalytics channels when Mike made a claim that a lot of these busts are guys who get drafted based on their ability to throw it across their body running left on their pro day or their crazy combine. And that was in regards to Anthony Richardson we were talking about. And several followers made a point that I wanted to bring to the podcast on their behalf.
Can I defend myself in advance?
Sure.
That is an observation purely based on anecdotal observations.
Okay.
No data whatsoever on that one.
Okay. Okay, so the counter to that anecdotal observation is that a lot of these top quarterbacks in recent years have been guys who maybe weren't quote-unquote winners in college and who weren't finished products, who were kind of more project guys. I think Patrick Mahomes was viewed that way. I think Josh Allen was viewed as this massive guy who probably threw too many interceptions but had a rocket arm and a lot of athletic ability. And with the right coaching staff who felt like they could mold him into who they wanted him to be, he could be a superstar. And so I think that's the argument in favor of drafting a guy like Will Levis, in favor of drafting a guy like Anthony Richardson. I'm not saying that's what I would do. I'm just simply putting that line of thought out there that, you know, when in regards to this Washington football team situation,
I would like to respond.
Okay.
Okay, so in some ways, this brings us back to the whole kind of Bill Parcells rules, right? And in some ways, right, the notion to some of Parcells' rules is it boils down to things like you got to be a winner, you got to be accurate, you've got to have experience. A lot of the busts out there have been, a lot of the more historical, generational busts have been guys that had essentially one good season, right? So they didn't have the prolonged excellence.
Yeah.
And so you talk about, let's say, a Ryan Leaf or, and I looked up the name, Jamarcus Russell as maybe the two sort of, and frankly, that was always my concern with the 49ers and Trey Lance.
Yeah.
So they are probably making a good point. It's just, you know, sort of two things can be true. We can talk about sort of the media hype from, you know, ESPN covering Sam Darnold's pro day at USC and he's throwing the ball great in the rain, and sort of this lack of prolonged winning or experience at the top of their game in college. So,
yeah, I think the Parcells rules really favor a guy like, I mean, the guy they really favor is Bryce Young. I think they favor Stetson Bennett. And he's one that I have never been a huge believer as far as like a starting NFL quarterback. But, and Georgia fans will hate me for saying that, but you know, but they don't favor Will Levis or Anthony Richardson. And if I'm Washington, I look at Will Levis or Anthony Richardson, and it's, you said a couple of weeks back, like with Richardson, there's like a 10% chance he ends up being a guy that wins you multiple Super Bowls, and there's a 50% chance he gets you fired or whatever. And I think Will Levis is in that same ballpark where it's like, could he develop and become Josh Allen? Is there a chance that that happens? Does he have the physical tools for that to happen? I think so. I don't think it's going to happen, but would you rather spend $4 million for a 10% chance at Josh Allen or $40 million for a guy who's definitely going to have you kind of right on the fringe of the playoffs, but has an injury history, who seems to be on a downward trajectory for the rest of his career in Lamar Jackson. And, but there's a higher floor, much higher floor with Lamar Jackson, and his ceiling's really high. We've seen him play at MVP level. So I don't want to disregard that, but it does seem like the numbers seem to indicate that running quarterbacks at this point in their careers, you know, their best days are behind them. That's the decision for a team like Washington.
And I think this kind of highlights one of the limitations of analytics.
Yeah.
And how sometimes analytics might tell you to do something, but the realities of human relationships, brand management, you know, managing your loyal customer fan base preclude you doing, you know, what might make sense. What might make sense is that you take a first round pick, you know, you take a quarterback in the early rounds or the first round or the early rounds of the NFL draft every 3 years until you find some guy that's going to play for 12 years and truly be at the top of the game.
And then you don't draft one for a while.
Yeah. You sort of play the controlled quarterback game and you kind of go, you know, maybe this guy will break through. I mean, but I don't think we've ever really seen it done, right? I mean, the last time we had something close to it was the Arizona Cardinals, who had, what was his name? Josh Rosen.
Kyler Murray.
They moved him out pretty quickly for Kyler Murray.
Yeah.
It might have been rational to have both those guys on the roster and keep them for as long as possible. Now, this brings us, usually we go from the top of these divisions down to the bottom. We started at the bottom this week. The New York Giants have a guy that, you know, after how about 4 years in the league, started to show some signs of breaking through, but maybe breaking through to the point of being a better than average quarterback rather than a great quarterback. And so for that organization, it's exactly what you're talking about. Do you want to have a guy that's, what did he get? $90 million guaranteed, I think. Something in that,
something like that.
I'll look it up in a second. But a decent amount of guaranteed money, not a crazy amount of guaranteed money. The Giants were 9-7. Are they locking themselves into having a journeyman type quarterback that has just enough upside that they can talk themselves into? He can be Eli Manning and win us a Super Bowl or two over the next decade.
Yeah, I think Daniel Jones is very fortunate to be with a franchise that won a quarterback who was perceived very similarly at this point in his career and won a Super Bowl. Because the Giants organization doesn't feel like they need to have an Aaron Rodgers or a Tom Brady to win Super Bowls. They feel like they need an Eli Manning. And okay, Doug, I think the verdict's still out, but Daniel Jones could be an Eli Manning.
Okay, Doug, so the deal was 4 years, $160 million with a $92 million signing bonus.
I mean, I'll take it. I don't think it's going to be worth his time to look at the price tags when he goes shopping. So he's set. Daniel Jones is set. And the Giants are, as much as it's not like a Lamar Jackson deal, they're also, it's big enough of a deal that they're not going to be able to take a look at any other quarterbacks the next few years, right? Like, they're locked into Daniel Jones. And so
they could. I mean, with a cost-controlled rookie quarterback.
Well, it's like, guy, I guess, Jalen Hurts.
Second round or something, right? You could play this. You know, you could do some exploration. But again, you get into the weirdness of, are you offending this guy that you just gave $90 million to?
Yeah, I think Jalen Hurts is a good example of a team. Like, the Eagles were pretty locked into Carson Wentz at the time when they drafted him. And so that might be the closest example we have to kind of your scenario in recent memory. And over the years, we've had teams draft quarterbacks pretty high that didn't need a quarterback simply because of how valuable the position is. The New England Patriots drafted Jimmy Garoppolo. The person
Aaron Rodgers was Jordan Love?
With Jordan Love, and even before Aaron Rodgers, they had Brett Favre and they drafted Aaron Rodgers. And so that's kind of been part of their philosophy this whole time. It's worked really well, of course, with Brett Favre and Aaron Rodgers. Seamless transition there. Jordan Love, TBD, but we'll see on that one. But yeah, Daniel Jones with the Giants. I mean, I've said 100 times that we've yet to see him with a good offensive line or good receivers. And so he can do, like, I'm impressed by Daniel Jones' ability to have an average outcome with below average surrounding talent. And that's kind of what he did this year that was impressive to people. But okay, that doesn't mean that he has the ability to make, with average talent, great outcomes, which is what Joe Burrow's done, I think, in my opinion. Or even with great surrounding talent to have great outcomes. Like, that might be his ceiling. We don't know. So he's kind of weird because he's been in the league for 4 years and it feels like the verdict is still out on Daniel Jones. The encouraging thing for Giants fans is that Brian Daboll, we talk a lot about coach quarterback pairs. That coach quarterback pair seemed to bring massive improvement to his game. And I think people expect more improvement, more momentum in that direction with Daboll and the continuity with Daniel Jones.
Okay. Can I say this? I'll make two.
Yeah.
Jones, 15 touchdowns last year, 5 interceptions. So a nice ratio, but. Yeah.
Well, he had some rushing touchdowns too.
Yeah, but I mean, throwing for 15 touchdowns suggests to me that you're, and actually, I mean, you're looking at it, he's never been a high volume touchdown guy. And I think that's probably the thing that suggests that his ceiling might not be all that high. The other thing is, as a New York Giants, and again, you mentioned Ted Lasso, right? It's like, there's competition between these clubs. There's rivalries between these clubs. In that case, it's an ex-husband or an ex-wife. And I guess they're both ex-husband and ex-wife. But, you know, for the Giants, are you suddenly, we sometimes I'll talk about how there's usually a second team. And from a brand equity perspective in any city, if Aaron Rodgers does end up with the New York Jets, is Daniel Jones suddenly really unexciting? And the glamour is not there.
I think he's already unexciting to a lot of people. As a Giants guy myself, I'm not mad about. I feel like the verdict's still out long term on Daniel Jones. A lot of people compare him to Kirk Cousins, and I think he's more athletic. He's a more athletic Kirk Cousins. I don't think that's a bad thing that, you know, to have a guy, because he's getting paid like, I think his pay is about relative to where he ranks in quarterbacks. So you're not paying him Lamar Jackson money. And I think Giants fans as a whole would have been really excited about Lamar Jackson coming in. but or Aaron Rodgers, for example. But long term, I don't know if that's the best move for the franchise. My concern with Daniel Jones was that he was going to go to a team like San Francisco or a team that had the pieces in play and really light it up. And the Giants were going to always regret that. Like when Brett Favre left the Falcons or when, and we've seen that Drew Brees leaving San Diego. Of course, he was already an elite quarterback. But Kirk Cousins leaving Washington and going to the Vikings and all of a sudden being an MVP caliber quarterback. And so I thought that was a possibility for Daniel Jones and out of fear. And so I'm kind of relieved that we're not going to see that happen.
Yeah. And I mean, from my perspective, I'll bottom line it. I think that, and I don't know what the perception is of the Giants have done the smart thing, you know, signing him to a moderate contract in terms of both length and dollars. I do suspect that they'll probably invest in, you know, some additional quarterback talent, right? Because the rookies are essentially free in a way, right? In terms of, you know, $4 or $5 million versus $40 or $50 million. So they seem to have done the smart thing, the non-emotional thing. The next guy on our list is Dak Prescott. Now, Prescott has always been an interesting guy, right? Because he came in as a mid-round draft pick. So Prescott never got the money.
Yeah.
Right. And so he had to go through all sorts of, you know, tribulations to get the Cowboys to pay him. There was an injury. He came back from the injury and probably and statistically had maybe one of the best years of his career. This last year really fell off quite a bit. And again, sort of let's see what the numbers are on the touchdowns to interceptions went from 37 and 10 in 21, 37 touchdowns to 23 touchdowns in 2022, and interceptions went up from 10 to 15. So Prescott, and again, he's playing in this ultra high pressurized environment. We've also seen Ezekiel Elliott really drop off in terms of performance. You know, Dallas is clearly a team that is not interested in having anything except the ultimate success. Prescott's a top 10, top 12 guy, I think, at this point. And he's not going to get the Cowboys to the land of Roger Staubach or of Troy Aikman. And so I think what we're going to see, the narrative that's going to play through with him over and over again, is it time for the Cowboys to move on? I think he's got just 2 years left in that deal because I think it was just a 4-year deal. Yeah. So very quickly, we're going to come up on another cycle of a contract that he's going to want to get paid. The media is going to say they got to pay him. He's the best Cowboy quarterback in a long time. And, you know, the number is going to go from $150 million on the last one to what, $220 million for the next 4 years? $250 million? So again, Prescott's an interesting guy, very high pressurized situation, but probably a guy that's locking Jerry Jones into a place where he doesn't want to be.
Yeah, and I think I got a sense from Cowboys fans this year that they're a little bit jealous of the Eagles situation because it seems like Dak Prescott's the more talented prospect than Jalen Hurts. Like, I think a lot of people thought Jalen Hurts was going to be a poor man's Dak Prescott. And Jalen Hurts has that leadership ability, that kind of sixth sense, that it factor that Dak Prescott has never showed in the biggest moments. And so I think that Cowboys fans, I mean, I remember 2 years ago when there was all this drama about, were they going to re-sign him? Were they going to trade him? And I think they're back in that situation.
Let's talk about these guys in parallel then. Cause I think that's a good thing. So, Hurts.
I mean, that's their competition really. That's their biggest competition.
Hurts has one more year before he becomes an unrestricted free agent. So, you know, and Philadelphia is paying him about $4 million next year, $4.5 million.
Yeah.
Now Hurts, you know, again, maybe the perception is he's, you know, got great leadership and played, you know, really some clutch football this year. I've heard people say that he was the best, better quarterback in the Super Bowl. He threw for 22 touchdowns and 6 interceptions, but that's the first time he's thrown for 20 touchdowns in his career. So he's a guy that is in some ways a one-hit wonder. And just as we might be concerned about one-hit wonders at the college ranks, we probably should be concerned about one-hit wonders at the NFL rank as well. Okay.
Vince Young comes to mind. I remember thinking he was going to... Colin Kaepernick comes to mind. He tore it up. Carson Wentz comes to mind. I remember people talking about him being MVP of the league. I mean, on a smaller scale, like Taylor Heineke had some big games. This year, the Cooper Rush had some big games, and people were starting to get excited. And late in the season, his name escapes me, the 49ers, like fourth string quarterback, who went on a little tear there as well. And so we've seen our share of one-hit wonders that didn't sustain the long-term success. I think like a good one-hit wonder was Tony Romo. He kind of had that special season, but he really was a solid quarterback for a long time, and I think he still would be if he were playing football. I think the verdict's out long term on Jalen Hurts. I think we've got to see him sustain that success, and I think Philly probably wants to see that in order to invest in him in the same way. You know, he's probably going to demand Lamar Jackson money, like after leading them to the Super Bowl after the year that he had this year. So we'll see what happens with Jalen Hurts. And maybe Philly decides to lock him in this offseason, try to sign him long-term. That'd be a bit of a gamble on their end, but to wait is a bit of a gamble as well, as we've seen.
Yeah, I want to... That is a good question. I don't know anything about if there are rumors of an extension for Jalen Hurts, but he was the biggest... If we want to think about sort of quarterbacks as stocks, he was probably the biggest mover last year. You know, yeah. We might argue that like Trevor Lawrence made the biggest leap forward, but I think almost everyone thought it was coming.
Yeah.
Jalen Hurts' leap was at the same level of Lawrence, but it was also ended up taking the Eagles to the Super Bowl, right? And you think about how big of a disaster the NFC East was perceived to be just a year or two in the past. And suddenly, you know, the Eagles are, you know, the top one or two teams in the league. They've got a quarterback that seems they can play with everyone. It's probably tempting as the management of the Eagles to say, we got our guy, let's lock him in. But, you know, I think you got to see it. And again, I could see social media crucifying me for this one as well. I think you got to see more, right? You can't put all those dollars out. And look, to some extent, Hurts might want to wait on the contract as well. Because what kind of deal do you give him? A Daniel Jones-like deal? Or a...
Lamar Jackson.
Lamar Jackson. Lorraine to see what he gets. So is
I know,
he
but a, what he's demanding. What he's demanding. I think Jalen Hurts, if he has another year like this last year, I think he can demand that Lamar Jackson deal. And I think that teams are willing to do it.
I think so, too.
They view him as a Super Bowl quarterback.
Right. And it's just a matter of, so if you're the Eagles, you got this dilemma of, you know, maybe we're willing to invest $90 million in guaranteed dollars to you, but you probably want $150 minimum, and maybe you're eyeing $200, right? Mm-hmm. And look, this could be one of the legacies of Lamar Jackson. Is he now in a position where he's going to roll the dice because he doesn't want $140 million or $150 million? He wants the $200 or the $250 million. And he's relatively close to getting to that point. It would be, you know, this could be Lamar Jackson's biggest impact on the game. Look, we've already talked about the AFC North, but I suspect that Lamar Jackson, everyone is watching every step of the way here in terms of what he's going to get, the way teams are reluctant to negotiate him with the franchise tag and not wanting to give up two picks, this issue of, you know, him trying to reset the quarterback market and all the NFL teams wanting to reset the quarterback market from Deshaun Watson downward. He wants to set it up.
Right. Yeah. And I also think the fact his name's just going to come up when we're talking about different divisions, because he has the potential to totally change the landscape of any division that he ends up in. So in this case, like it perception's kind of Philly, Dallas, New York, Washington. But if Washington lands Lamar Jackson, an 8-8 team, it's, you know, last year, the analytics really aren't that much different than Cleveland when they added Deshaun Watson, where the perception was, okay, now they've got a, you know, they've been winning 8 games with mediocre talent. Now they have a potential MVP caliber quarterback. And this could take them to the next level. I think Washington is a team to keep an eye on where it's like, they could be favorited in the NFC East next year.
Doug, I want to, you know, let me ask you, pick this division from first to fourth.
I mean, I got to go Philly.
As of right now. Yeah.
Right now I got Philly first, Washington last. You know, I'll say it. I'll go with the G-men over Dallas. I'll go with the Giants second in the division.
And if Lamar Jackson ends up playing for the Washington Commanders, where do they?
It's a loaded division. It's a loaded division at that point. And I kind of still.
You pick them one or you pick them two then?
No, I kind of could see. I could see a Cleveland situation like last year where they get all the hype and going into the season, people are talking about them as favorites. And they end up third and Dallas is fourth or the Giants are fourth. But yeah, I still see them. I don't see them passing Philly for sure with what Philly has going right now. Philly is a well-oiled machine that I expect to see competing for Super Bowls for years to come.
Okay, Doug, we're over time. So let's do this real quick. We are currently watching two shows, The Mandalorian and Ted Lasso. I am watching them both eagerly. I think The Mandalorian has figured some stuff out. They seem a little bit more geared towards at least starting each episode with some classic Star Wars action. Some of the plot points are probably not where they should be in terms of having something where it's compelling from week to week. Ted Lasso, I'm also going to say, look, they returned to the field. Some focus on the players, which yeah. I think was helpful. Both of those on a 10-point scale for me are still hovering around that 6.5 kind of level of I'm going to keep watching, but I'm not loving them the way I... Let me say this. I'm not loving them the way I want to love them.
Yeah, I'll just say that Ted Lasso, I thought, had a nice bounce-back episode, and it has me back in. I'm back, like, I'm locked in every Wednesday waiting to see what happens with this franchise. The Mandalorian has had moments. I think it's those flashback scenes or those cuts to Coruscant that feel like Star Wars, that feel special. But as a whole, I don't know that anyone really knows what the overarching, like what the story arc is for the season. It's kind of all over the place. And I don't know what the objective is or what the real conflict is and what the characters are setting out to achieve. And so I think that's a criticism I've seen across the board. We'll see if they tie it all together. I know there's a lot of people skeptical about that. I know there's a lot of people optimistic about that. But those are two very passionate fandoms that are very opinionated about those two projects. And, you know, like I said, I'm feeling a little more optimistic about Ted Lasso now after last week's episode. The Mandalorian, I enjoyed seeing the plot twist of the year, which was the Jar Jar Binks actor playing the role of the Jedi that saved... spoiler alert, turn it off if you haven't seen it yet, that saved Grogu from the Jedi Temple during Order 66. That was very surprising.
That is too aggressive of a spoiler. Okay.
I gave him an alert. It's just like the Jar Jar Binks guy playing a Jedi. It would have been better, though, if it had been Jar Jar himself.
In the world of streaming, you know, the spoilers are out there. You know, it's all over the internet. It's all over,
and it's been a week. Yeah. Like, you've had a week. Come on now. I think Succession is the big show right now, though. Succession is probably the next one we got to keep up with because it's getting a lot of buzz. Has, at the moment, 100% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Doug, the other thing is there's got to be a return to the theater for me for something other than Fast and the Furious, and that's John Wick 4. Okay, so we'll wrap it there. As always, more content at www.fandomanalytics.com.